Welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. This is David.
And Amanda.
And the Podcast Whisperer.
That would be John, I guess.
No, I'm mostly making fun of you.
Yeah, well.
Surprise.
Well, it's awfully good to be back in this lovely studio with the two of you. And this is it's a lot of fun just to get to sit down and argue. And
it's been too long.
It has been way too long.
I'm pretty sure I picked up asthma on my way over here tonight because the air quality is... I didn't even know purple was an air quality thing until today.
Really? It's purple?
We're moving into purple.
Is that the level above red?
It's the level above red, and I think the next level is the plague.
Like black.
We all die.
Yeah, we all die. Zombie apocalypse.
I like how you have asthma, but I was the one that rode my bike.
Well, I don't really have asthma. I was exaggerating. But...
Oh, really? For effect?
Yes.
Oh. Okay.
It's called hyperbole.
Dun, dun.
How do you spell that?
I have no clue. There's an H and a Y and a P.
I think it's Greek.
Probably.
Yeah. From the root or the origin word hyperbolus.
Meaning John.
Oh, gosh.
So today, I thought we'd be pretty fun to hear if John has got a random song of the week.
I have a good one. I have a really good one. I've been listening to this for the last couple days. This is not a 90s reference. This is a pretty recent song. In fact, I think this is, this year. And it's off of Jason Isbell's most recent record. Here, we'll start. Here we go. It's called If We Were Vampires, which the title doesn't do it justice.
That makes it sound very scary.
Makes it sound scary?
Yes, yeah. Because it's conjuring Edward and Bella.
It'd be scary if it was called, if this song were called Twilight.
It's not the long flowing dress that you're in, or the light coming off of your skin, the fragile heart you protected for so long, or the mercy in your sense of right and wrong.
It's so pretty.
It's not your hand searching slow in the dark, or your nails feeling love's watermark. It's not the way you talk me off the moon. Your questions like directions to the truth. It's knowing that this can't go on forever. Likely one of us will have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together. But one day I'll be gone. One day you'll be gone.
Don't mock cry, dude. You know you like that song.
I do
like it.
Don't
be making fun of that.
I do like it. It's fantastic.
There are multiple lines in there that I like.
The lyrics, his lyrics of that song... consolidate so many ideas into such a small,
yes,
compact punch. He's a great songwriter.
That resonates with me.
Yeah.
I have a pact with my husband that I get to die first.
Well, that's...
That's awfully convenient.
That's, yeah.
Well...
How did that pact come down?
I have no intention.
Is that written into the wedding nuptials or something?
I have no intention of living without him. And so...
So that's just how it's going to go, huh?
So that's just how it's going to go.
Okay.
I hope.
So today's podcast is on the legalization of assisted suicide and Mandy's... Never mind.
Well, yeah. Aren't we off to a bright and cheery start?
Well, I'm sure we have cheerier places to go.
Probably.
Cheerfulness?
Well, I have fantastic news. We have a listener.
You're kidding.
I am not even kidding.
Someone married to one of us, right?
No, not even that.
What?
Yes. I got an email from Jana L. from Honolulu, Hawaii.
I think I know who that is.
Shh, you're not supposed to give it away.
Oh, okay.
So,
the Podcast Whisperer is back.
Yes, I am. So, Jana says she would love to hear a discussion from the three of us on happiness. What is real happiness and what is a right attitude toward happiness? What's the role of happiness in our Christian, parental, relational, public life?
That's not an easy question.
No, it isn't.
So are we going to spend the rest of the podcast on this topic, or are we going to try to give a brief response to this.
Well, so when you talk, when you talk about happiness, what's the first thing that comes to mind in your life as opposed happiness as something that you strive for?
It's the American Manifesto.
Pursuit of.
Is it something deeper in your soul you long for as happiness, or is it the highest ideal?
Well, when you say that, what's the first thing that comes to mind? The first thing that comes to mind is the life. Decades of my life that I spent depressed, not, you know, happiness. When I hear what is happiness, I think about how that's, I don't know if any human ever feels like they have grasped it, but I definitely think about the failure to grasp it. Or the years of my life I spent not only not happy, but not feeling like happiness was a possibility. So that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
The thing that comes to my mind is that I totally picked the wrong song. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
And bringing us down.
So
pop culture reference.
DJ John over here. So, Amanda, would you say that coming out on the other side of that, that you value happiness more?
Well, no, I don't think I would. I think that I would say I understand it differently. It's when you say the word happiness, you think about mood, or I think about mood, like how do I feel? But that hasn't been. It's not like I came out of the other side of depression and then spent the rest of my days smiling. I think when talking about happiness and its, you know, what it means in the context of a Christian life or what it means in the context of a human life, I don't think any of us are wired for any kind of permanent state of happiness. And I don't think that we're meant to even desire that. That satisfaction and joy are very, very distinct from happiness, and they're truly human emotions, where happiness is a very transitory.
But like, okay, so I'm playing the devil's advocate, but that...
No,
the
really?
Whole
cultural, like, everything in our culture says, and everything in the American mythology says that happiness is the ultimate good. Like, that is what we are to pursue beyond all other things. And so much of the... Even the discussions that we have on issues of morality or issues of how to use our finances or issues of whether we should stay together in our marriages are based around the concepts of happiness and does this how it makes me feel. And so feelings are very bound up in this whole concept of happiness. And so you're saying we're not hardwired for it, and yet it seems to be the thing that we ultimately pursue, at least in the West. In
the West, in materialist, secularist culture.
In my Apple commercial that I saw.
Right, yeah. I think it is a cultural ideal in America.
I think it is the cultural ideal.
Okay, yeah. And it's bound up with concepts of pleasure.
Freedom.
Image, self-image.
Yeah.
All kinds of things.
It seems like happiness is almost like that cultural disconnect between love and love. Everybody says love, but that's not really the love that is real love. And
which is probably what Jan is getting at when she says the difference between happiness and joy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The correlate but not equivalent joy.
Right. So, I mean, a well-targeted question that already is making that distinction. And so I think it's hard to talk about it without indicting our entire culture on all levels for the shallowness of materialism and the shallowness of, you know, that transitory emotion being set up as a permanent ideal.
So I think to not throw the entire culture under the bus, then I think the place where I have had to come to a realization. So this last couple of years there's been a lot of disappointments in my life, and it's not like I am dealing with anything catastrophic. My marriage is healthy. My children are healthy. We don't have cancer. There's nothing you can really point to and go, that just sucks. But there's been disappointments, and one of the things I've wrestled with is when I've read through the book of Proverbs and I look at, hey, do this and this and this, and essentially your life will go well. And then I'm like, whoa, what gives? There's not a lot of happiness right now. It just is disappointing. And so I keep on turning to the less happy book of Ecclesiastes.
My favorite book of the Old Testament.
Is it?
Yes.
Are you being...
No, absolutely my favorite book of the Old Testament.
Favorite book.
Because
and why?
Of this exact issue.
Okay, so is this your favorite verse in Ecclesiastes?
I don't know. You'll have to read it.
Go eat your bread with pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Drink your wine with a cheerful heart. For God has already accepted your works. Let your clothes be white all the time. Never let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife you love all the days of your fleeting life.
Yep.
Which have been given you under the sun all your fleeting days. For that is your portion in life and in your struggle under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your strength, because there is no work, planning, knowledge, or wisdom in Sheol where you are going.
Yeah, that's my favorite passage in the Old Testament right there.
Is it?
It is. It absolutely is. I've actually read it in staff meetings before as an exhortation to put your shoulder to the wheel, do the work that's in front of you, and let go of the long-term result, because you are not in charge of whether this works or not. You are not in charge of whether you enjoy it or not. You are in charge of doing the work that's in front of you and then letting go of it and going and eating your bread and drinking your wine and loving your spouse. And because all the work I do crumbles to dust.
That's totally funny, because I hate that passage. That's the only.
I love it.
No, I'm just kidding. I was just being controversial for controversial's sake. No, yeah, for the same reasons, because happiness is a fleeting thing too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I built a business and then had to close it. I, you know, wrote a 70-page master's thesis, and now it's filed on a shelf gathering dust.
Mm-hmm.
I go into work every day and I teach.
And argue with 16-year-olds.
And I argue with 16-year-olds, mostly successfully. But what is the success of an argument with a 16-year-old that maybe...
Pearls before swine.
Maybe it's when fleeting. They're 40. It is fleeting. Maybe when they're 40, they will... Something I have said will momentarily be useful to them when they're arguing with their own 16-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to die. The 16-year-old they're arguing with is going to die. The 16-year-old that 16-year-old eventually argues with is
going to
die. Now
Jesus is going to come back before then.
Well, clearly. Maybe, maybe not. But the legacy I leave is a legacy of dust. And acceptance of that and delight in that, I think, is actually deeply, deeply encouraging.
So then banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless.
Meaningless. Speaking of which, my 16-year-olds, my sophomores, couldn't believe it when I told them. They're incredulous when I told them that there was no amount of money they could pay me to be 16 again. They assumed that I would want to be 16. Absolutely.
You don't want to be 16 again?
Not for any money in the world.
Really?
Absolutely.
Your childhood sucked.
Well, I think that's been well established.
That's horrible.
You would want to be 16 again?
Absolutely.
With all of the foolishness, the lack of self-control, the
absolutely.
Pain and agony that you have between 16 and 30, whatever you...
37, yeah. 21 years ago? Yeah,
21
totally.
Years.
Totally.
21 years of learning, 21 years of accumulated wisdom. You would discard that?
Yes.
For more energy?
Yes.
And, oh, wow. Not for anything. You couldn't pay me to go back.
You had a terrible childhood.
Well, yes.
Okay.
But I don't even think that that's the issue. I wouldn't be 21 again. And I was independent at 21 and building my own life.
Well, I think that... So this kind of goes against the song that I just played that was talking about the importance of mortality. But I... Yeah.
You would be immortal?
The importance of mortality.
No, I'm saying that there is importance in... There is a type of importance to mortality. However, the thought of being 16 again sounds fantastic to me. I would have to put on the brakes and come up with reasons why you wouldn't make that choice, not the other way around. Like, oh, wait, no way. No way. I'd be like, yes, sign me up. Put me at the front of that line.
Wow. I can't even imagine. And I've got the aching muscles.
There could be a song there. You could write that song. I can only imagine has been written, but I can't even imagine it's got to be a country hit somewhere.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, no.
What about you, David? 16 again?
You know, 16 was great. It was probably...
You and I met when we were 16.
Yeah. 16 was probably...
Well, so this is the problem. I just didn't know you guys.
Yes.
Otherwise,
I honestly think,
awesome.
And we were friends with Melissa.
Yeah.
That was long before John and Melissa, but yeah. If you would have known, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty confident.
16 was so much fun. It was probably the first time that I really... Well, this kind of brings it full circle again. I guess you could say it was the first time that I was really happy, that I really had a measure of joy in my relationships and friendships. But all that said, I look at the years since and all the things that have brought me to where I am today, and to give that up would be such a bitter pill to swallow.
I couldn't
to be where I am with right. the friendships and relationships and the place that I am in life. It seems like it would be a real bitter pill to swallow.
It would actually just be fleeting in a chasing after the wind. I thought we already established that.
Right. All of our works are dust.
Yeah.
The 21 years of wisdom, dust.
Yeah. Vapors.
Go back to 16 and fight
just
those battles
it.
All over again.
Yeah. Ecclesiastes basically is the favorite book of the Bible for all vape shops.
Oh, that's bad.
Wow. There's like a great advertising campaign there. the Ecclesiastes.
Today's podcast brought to you.
By Raspberry Vapes. 20% the nicotine of regular cigarettes.
So now that we've established thoroughly, completely, and profoundly philosophically the meaning of happiness in life, any big questions?
Well, I was just thinking, as I was just pondering back on my life, I was thinking... I was so dumb for so long. The level of just, wow.
See, again, this is why Mandy wouldn't go back to being 16, because she never experienced that part of being...
Oh, I'm sure Mandy was dumb.
Very, very dumb. And just think, in another 21 years, we get to look back at our 30-something selves and go, oh my goodness.
At least...
I was such an idiot. And I recorded it.
I don't expect to ever have that thought.
Really?
No.
At least now.
My adult life is a series of 6-month cycles of going, oh, I finally learned this lesson. Oh, I have so many more lessons to learn.
I agree with that. I just don't think I have that level of like self-loathing and like...
You don't have the same level of self-loathing that I do.
No, I don't. I think I have a very high sense of self-forgiveness. Oh, I was dumb. What do you know? I was 16. Oh, my goodness. Like every other 16-year-old.
I had this fantastic quote, and I just can't find it anywhere.
Just make it up. It's cool.
I read it once.
Attribute it to Abraham Lincoln.
In an Abraham Lincoln book. It was a George MacDonald book. And this guy says... A man's life is a series of epochs between inspiration and being able to wrap that new knowledge into the rest of his life until finally in old age, he begins to be able to accept the new and the old together. Mm. And
that George MacDonald guy was smart.
At once kind of becomes one. I'll try to look it up and bring it next week because it's a pretty
smart
quote.
He was 16.
I think I read that when I was 16.
You probably did. When I was 16, I wasn't reading that.
So Amanda and I bumped into each other this past weekend at the farmer's market here in Boise, and we got into this fabulous conversation. I don't even know how we bumbled into this, but we had this really interesting conversation on the sidewalk about
While our children rode in the traffic, or my children rode out in traffic.
Yeah, your kids were riding out into the street, and Jared was rolling his eyes. And we were having this conversation about, can you be a Christian and be a feminist? Or what is the Christian response to feminism? Or like, and we just touched on it, and your eyes lit up, and then we stopped. So where were you going to go with that? I want to know. I really want to know.
Well, I don't know that I had like a destination in mind, but I think it's an enormously fascinating conversation because I get to live in really interesting worlds. And in one world, I'm the crazy liberal feminist with the short hair. And in another world, I'm the psycho conservative who actually promised to obey her husband in her wedding vows. And so it's a delightfully dual identity that I think is challenging to inhabit in a healthy way, but also is productive for, I don't know, being reflective about the positions we take. So, yeah, can you be a Christian and a feminist? And I think absolutely. But of course, that depends on how you define your terms.
Okay, so define your terms.
Okay, so I'm not sure if I can formulate exactly the definition of feminist that I would sign off on, but I know for a fact that there's a wide range of feminisms between, hey, women are people too, and...
It seems like there would be a joke to insert there, except that it's been so badly, women have been so badly treated over the years, it wouldn't be funny.
It's not funny.
Right.
Although, yes, I'm sure there is a hilarious joke in there, and we wouldn't want to, you know, do anything to extend the stereotype of the humorless feminist.
Yes, humorlessness of it.
Right. I think I have a sense of humor somewhere. but somewhere between, hey, women are people too, and... redefining gender and all roles and relationships and absolutely forbidding any, moral restrictions on, sexuality and childbearing. I think I definitely fall more towards the simple women are people too end of the spectrum, but I think that we actually have a lot of work to do in the church to discuss how to handle that identification of women as human beings made in God's image.
Okay, so just respond to this. This is from when I was 16.
Yes.
I did a music camp as a kid, and in our, like, whatever the... musical drama was, the silly stupid song about where the women all stood up and they sang anything you can do, we can do better, we can do anything better than you. So respond to that within the context of,
well, that's just dumb.
okay,
because you're 16 year olds.
Well, and that was a musical, like a Broadway musical. Those are lyrics from a Broadway musical.
I'm sorry, I'm totally out of the loop here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so that idea...
That espoused an idea of feminism.
Anything you can do, I can do better. That's just dumb, because that's obviously untrue on an individual level as well as on a group level.
It's hyperbole. But...
Yes.
Okay.
And so denying the fact that there might be things that men are better at than women or women are better at than men is just closing your eyes to human history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to use this as an example, just because I think it's so striking. My husband's not a big guy. He weighs 5 whole pounds more than I do. Mm-hmm. But if we're joking around or wrestling or whatever, he can hold me down with one arm without even trying. Mm-hmm. So just on the bare physical strength issue, it doesn't even take a strong man to be stronger than a strong woman. I mean, I'm not weak for a girl.
Sure. And there's always, you can find the exceptions to the rule, but in general.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Right. But on the whole, men are much, much stronger than women physically. On the whole, women are at least as tough, if not much tougher than men when it comes to the bearing pain end of the spectrum.
Right. Absolutely.
And so, but then, of course, you know, like, women bear children and men can't. And that's a really obvious biological difference with significant effects in how society conducts itself. And trying to define those differences away, I think, is incredibly damaging to men and women.
So are you a feminist?
Yes.
But you haven't defined feminism yet.
Okay. Well, I told you I wasn't ready to define the form of feminism that I'm absolutely ready to sign off on.
How can you say you are if you can't define it?
I think that it's important to identify as a feminist because I think it's important to address the systemic issues in human society the systemic issues of oppression that women experience.
Okay, so
in human society.
I think saying
I'm a feminist is a good way to start addressing that.
Okay, wait. So David, when she says that, does that make your skin crawl?
Oh yeah, totally. Absolutely. But let me try to define feminism for you.
Oh, you're going to tell me what I have to agree to?
Oh yeah, absolutely, because I'm a man.
Oh, of course.
Oh my goodness. This should be good. Go
good
for
luck
it.
With this.
Feminism.
She won't even try to define it. You're going to define it. Go.
Well, right. She won't define it, so I'm just going to give it a shot.
Okay.
Feminism is the belief that women are inherently valuable and just as worthwhile as men.
Absolutely. That's women are people too.
Super simple and clear and something I think that
so then David,
everybody
you aren't
ought
a feminist?
To be able to agree on.
So David, you self-identify as a feminist?
Oh man, I think the self-identifying makes my skin crawl more than the feminism
part. Which is why I phrased it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, but then there are definitely definitions of feminism that none of us will sign off on. There are feminist philosophers who argue that if you are anti-abortion, you cannot identify as a feminist. And that's not, I don't know if it's a majority or a minority opinion within the broader world of feminist philosophy, but that is definitely an argument that's put forward. And so I am cautious about saying I'm a feminist because I absolutely cannot sign off on that belief.
And would you say that belief is rooted in the idea that you, a man or anybody, nobody should be able to tell a woman what to do with her body?
I think that that's one formulation of it. I think that probably a better and more charitable way to phrase that is that the ways that men have historically been violent to women has involved sexuality and reproduction. And that reclaiming that territory and saying, men especially, you can't tell a woman how and when to bear a child, is a way of addressing the war violence against women, where an act of war involves systematically raping all the women in the conquered city in order to force them to bear the children and to bear the shame of their conquerors. And so I don't think your average third wave feminist on a college campus is thinking about the sack of Troy and Agamemnon's exhortation, or no, it was Odysseus's exhortation to his soldiers that none of them should go home until they have bedded a faithful Trojan wife. But those historical patterns of sexual violence and forced reproduction are definitely components of that aspect of feminist philosophy.
Boy, the correlation to the race issues that we're seeing in our country and on those very same levels are really interesting.
Clarify what you mean.
Well, we're just seeing so many issues where Black people are struggling with the systemic racial after effects of slavery.
Right.
And
I would say the systemic effects of white supremacy.
Sure.
Because slavery is not the only component here.
Sure, absolutely. Where even if it's not something where it's even purposeful or intentional, it's perhaps just a kind of a historic after effect almost. that's sort of still echoing through our culture.
So that talking about feminism trying to address these issues and doing, especially with the issue of abortion, I think, defending something that's indefensible because something else is indefensible. We might also look at some of the ways that we're having a hard time finding common ground with our with the black members of our culture because of how these systemic issues are still having an effect on day-to-day life.
And I don't know that we found really an answer on the racial side. And so I don't know that that's a good guide to go for solving the feminism problem either.
Well, I don't know who we is that's supposed to solve all of our racial issues, but we're certainly not at a healthy point in our culture with racial issues. But I think there is a corollary here, which is that the people who have been victimized should have a privileged position in the conversation, that we don't necessarily have to accept all of the solutions that women put forward to systemic oppression of women, but we definitely should privilege their voices in that conversation.
That's a great point.
Okay. And then likewise with the racial issues, we shouldn't be sitting back here going, hey, I mean, you can't see into our studio, but we're a very white group. We shouldn't be sitting back here saying, well, we figured out how to solve these racial issues. If only everyone would listen to us. We should be privileging, you know, the African-American, Latino voices that have come up with things that we need to address.
So I think if I were going to push back on anything about any of this, and it's that one of the great hammers that's being used right now in culture is the victim hammer. And that isn't I don't want to take anything away from the legitimacy of the argument that the black community is saying about systemic white privilege. And I don't want to take anything away from what
systemic
you said.
Systemic white supremacy.
White supremacy, white privilege, yes. So, but the frustrating thing is right now in culture is that it feels like the voices that are being given the stage primarily are those who say, I have been victimized at the loudest, and that there is that carries more legitimacy than even good arguments do. And there is an emotional appeal that is wrapped up in that victim speech that we respond to. And my fear is that we will respond to the victimization irrationally and emotionally rather than coming to good conclusions, well thought out good conclusions to actually address racial injustice and you know, the abuse of women, whatever the argument is that we're having. We kind of got off topic there a little bit.
Right, but whatever the particular issue is, that the identity of victimization is not some kind of pass to circumvent argument or circumvent reason.
Right, well, yeah, and that just because you've been a victim doesn't necessarily mean you have an answer.
Right. But, and so then I would say, stepping back from the whole idea of public discourse for a moment and thinking about this in the context of the church, that the idea that we need to address these issues, reasonably, theologically, and in a, primarily in a way grounded in the historical teaching of the church, doesn't preclude starting with weeping with those who weep. So that when,
no, I think we have to understand. I think we have to understand the position of the victim. I just don't think we have to take the conclusion of the victim.
I agree, but I don't think we can come to a conclusion until we have made sure that we have fully listened to,
which many haven't.
Right.
Yeah.
There's way too much agreeing going on here for the Donnybrook podcast.
Well, maybe we should bring up something more controversial in order to start a serious argument.
Can you think of anything like that, Amanda?
Well, you know, it's... Yeah, well, evangelical America in the 21st century, so...
Maybe there's something there.
There might be something rocketing around the blogosphere. Is the blogosphere even a thing anymore? Or is it the podcastosphere or the Twittersphere?
The interwebs.
The interwebs. Oh, boy. If we ever get our friend Brent to listen to this, just hearing interwebs will make him unsubscribe immediately.
He'll squirm.
Definitely. So
in the midst of last week,
where there was nothing else going on in the world,
right? The
it was a very mellow week.
It was
in the U.S.
Nothing really going on.
Our president hadn't tweeted any policy changes. Massive storms had not made landfall
in the last 24 hours.
Nuclear war was not being actively threatened.
Exactly.
However,
a group of
yes, evangelical pastors and thought leaders, or were they all pastors? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, thought leaders
signed off on the so-called Nashville statement, that articulated a pretty run-of-the-mill conservative position on gay marriage and gay sexuality.
Human sexuality.
Yeah. I actually haven't read it.
It's broader.
I'm trusting you guys to articulate it for me.
It's actually like focused on, I mean, it certainly is focused on the gay issue, but it's also, there's a lot of it that has to do with transgenderism and sexual identity as well.
Does it have anything to say about heterosexual morality?
Yes.
Like, you know, marriage is for glorifying God and procreation.
So
and
it's
all that good stuff.
It's designed, it's in, there's a preamble and there's 14 articles, and each article has an
Sounds
affirmation.
Like the Constitution.
Well, yeah, it has an affirmation and a denial. And the very first one says, "We affirm that God has designed marriage to be a covenantal, sexual, procreative, lifelong union of one man and one woman as husband and wife, and is meant to signify the covenant love between Christ and his bride, the church."
Seems hard to argue with.
So,
does it go on to say anything controversial, John?
And then, "We deny that God has designed marriage to be a homosexual, polygamous, polyamorous relationship. We also deny that marriage is a mere human contract, and that a covenant made before God."
So in general, I mean, in general, the statement, the Nashville statement as a whole, supports an orthodox view of marriage.
Okay.
And
as rooted in the created order. I identified with Christ and the church.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so there's nothing that significantly deviates from an orthodox position. There's some very, I do take some exceptions with some of the terminology that they use, because I don't know what they mean. They use the word self-conception in there. I'm not familiar with that terminology. I don't know what they're getting at when they sell. I have a guess.
Right.
But when you start introducing brand new terminology into an already
complex
situation, and then you start talking about self-conception,
Here's an example. "We affirm that this is in Article 5, we affirm the difference between male and female reproductive structure are integral to God's design for self-conception as male or female."
Okay, so that does seem very... squishy in one way, but knowing probably some of the people that signed off on it, I think I can guess what they mean.
I can guess what they mean, but I shouldn't have to
right,
guess.
Right.
If they're going to ask a whole bunch of Christians to sign off on it, we shouldn't be guessing.
See if this makes any more sense. "We deny that physical anomalies or psychological conditions nullify the God-appointed link between biological sex and self-conception as male or female."
Yeah. So David and I have a difference of opinion on this. So David, what's your position?
So let's tease that out a little bit.
Yeah. What's your thought, David?
I think that the Nashville statement is an important moment in the life of the modern church. Issues of sexuality and gender identity are hold such a prominent place in our society, and we're seeing such a push for transgenderism, the rise of transgenderism and homosexuality in the last decade, that we're seeing a lot of inroads in the church, and a lot of churches that are, I guess, I don't really have a better way of saying it than going soft and stepping away from the biblical ethic. So I think this is a very important statement, an important moment in the modern church, saying, look, this is the this is what the Bible says, and here's truth.
Okay, so I'm curious what John has to say to that, but I also I want to ask, if you say that it's an important moment, so already it does seem like some of the phrasing, it was not well thought out in order to be something that all evangelical Christians could sign off on, something well defined. So if it is so significant and important, and I'm not arguing that point at all, I think that is good. Shouldn't it have been better designed, better written, better defined? Did anybody know this was coming out? Was there like a I don't know, a council?
Well,
maybe not in Nicaea, but to get sign off of large.
I think that my understanding is that this happened at the ERLC conference. I think they got together.
Should I know what that is?
The Ethics and Religious Liberty Council. It's Russell Moore's group.
Oh, okay.
With the Southern Baptists.
Yeah, Southern Baptist Convention.
I believe that it was at that conference that this got finalized and ratified. I can't disagree with you about the self-conception thing. It's hard to understand. I don't quite understand what that's going for.
Yeah, if I think of myself in not perfectly gendered, culturally gendered terms or biblically gendered terms, then yeah.
Well, self-concept is the way in which you think about yourself and the way in which you see yourself as a person.
So if I see myself as a particularly masculine woman, then, which I'm not saying I do,
there's all kinds of problems. Like what if you see yourself, I don't think that this statement makes much room. There's problems with this statement for Christians who view themselves in an egalitarian standpoint.
Right. They're,
like, if you have a perspective that a woman can be in a pastoral role, there's problems with this statement. There's like, because that's self-conception.
The Southern Baptists aren't particularly concerned about that, are they?
Well, I think the primary purpose of the statement is what David said, is to push back against LGBTQ agenda. But these are the overflow kind of things that need to be thought of before you start going out and saying, hey, everybody, come sign our big statement so that we can all be on the same bandwagon and fight against the world. And I think that's part of the question I don't have a clear picture. Like, what's the point of this statement? Like, who out there needed a better definition of Orthodox marriage? David, did you not know what Orthodox marriage was before the Nashville statement?
Well, a lot of people are talking about
Orthodox
marriage.
I'm not asking other people. I'm asking you.
Yes, I knew.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And how many people do you know who you could go to and say, hey, Orthodox view of marriage, yes or no? And they would be vague.
I don't think that.
How many people, David?
That's the point.
Okay. That's the problem. What is the point is that they're making a smaller tent that they can, they're building a wall. They're building a wall so that out of fear to put the LGBTQ community
is it a beautiful arm's length wall?
It is a beautiful.
Is it the best wall?
And we are going to make the LGBT community pay for it.
So John, you see this as preaching to the choir. The convinced are already
in a small choir.
In a smaller choir. So
yeah.
So we have
and I'm not talking about progressive Christians. I'm saying
But even in conservative Christianity, you have egalitarian views And if we're going to define the egalitarians out of the tent, then we're not unifying the church.
We can't unify the church through caving on serious moral issues.
But is it caving on a serious moral issue to include?
Who's caving? If you say I have an orthodox view of marriage, how is that caving?
No, caving is the churches that say, well, you know what, we're going to marry gay people.
But they're going to do that regardless of the Nashville statement. What good have you accomplished? I can't sign off on the Nashville statement. And the reason I can't is because the purpose of it does not appear to actually have a nuanced and deep and appreciative conversation on a complex issue. There are people who genuinely deal with gender dysphoria. And they have been written out.
So I think what might be useful here is to think back to, so David, you're on board with this because you think it's really, and I think we agree with you on this level, that it's really important not to change Christian doctrine in the face of worldly pressure. And we're definitely facing worldly pressure to change Christian doctrine.
Absolutely.
Okay, but if we look back at the times when the church has dealt well with these kinds of issues, it has been with large groups of people talking for a long time and looking for ways to keep everybody under the tent of Christianity without giving into the heresy. So I'm thinking about
Billy Graham going in and saying, hey, I'm not going to do a crusade here unless we have all the churches on board, not just the conservatives, not just the Bob Joneses of the world. I want the mainline churches on board too.
Well, and I'm thinking back to, you know, Council of Nicaea, one of the primary goals of which was to defend
that far.
Well, it's the one I know. So do you want me to sound knowledgeable or not?
Okay, fine.
All right. So going back to the Council of Nicaea, and one of the primary goals is to deal with the heresy of Arianism within the church. And the conversation goes on for months and includes representatives from churches all over the world. And in the end, only one bishop can't sign off on the statement that they come up with. Not because there weren't a lot of bishops that were sympathetic to the view of Arianism before, but because of the way that they approached that debate and the way they carefully worded the Nicene Creed to clearly define the nature of Jesus without introducing unnecessary obstacles to people that were having an issue with defining his humanity and his godhood. So, and even that one bishop that ends up excommunicated actually ends up being admitted later, but there are other issues going on there. And there was that whole thing where Saint Nick punched a guy. The Nashville statement seems, my impression here is that it's a limited group of people composing, signing, and publishing it without even getting out of their immediate ecumenical context, much less thinking about how can we declare the gospel in a way that shows its loveliness to the people that we disagree with.
Are you suggesting that a better way
is punching people?
Would have been to punch people.
Yes. No.
Are you suggesting that a better way would have been to have a number of different congregations, liberal congregations in, to try to come to an agreement on the biblical text?
Well, I think that it should have. Yes. And well, I don't know where I would have set the limit.
I don't even know
but
that there needs to be a statement. Like, why are we having a statement?
Well, because in the cultural moment we're in, this is a very public and ongoing conversation. So somebody felt it necessary to say something. I'm not saying I agree with them, but if you're going to say something, shouldn't you be looking for the way to say, let's have
sure,
the African church, the South
with,
American church,
I'm not
the
disagreeing
Asian
with
church.
The good thinking that you just applied to the whole situation. I'm saying back it up another step entirely and say, why are we making a statement? We've made these statements.
What is the pastoral purpose of making the statement? Is this
right.
Is this going to unify the church?
So,
is this going to reconcile us to...
Amanda, would you ever go up to a person and
you
they
know
are
the answer
clearly,
to this question.
They are clearly overweight. And you would go up to them and say, hey, you're fat.
Absolutely not.
Why not? It's the truth. They're going to die. They're going to die from their gluttonous behavior.
But John, this.
Wait, let's have this conversation. Why didn't we have a statement on the issue of 60 to 70% of Christians struggling routinely with pornography? Or why didn't we have a statement on the divorce rate in the church that's no different than the world? Oh, that's right. We have no moral authority because a bunch of those evangelical leaders recommended that we all vote for a president who says horrible sexual things about women that really aren't much different than the kinds of behaviors in the Old Testament that they want to call despicable.
Wow, we're really getting off track now.
Well, I don't think we're actually all that far off track because if we're going to issue a statement back to, okay, it needs to be more ecumenical, it also needs to address the actual sins that we're committing, not the sins that we're having fun pointing our fingers at other people saying you're committing. It's really easy in the church to sit around and say, hey, we're not sinning like those.
It's called discipleship. Discipleship is addressing the problems that we are having as disciples.
So I can't disagree with anything you just said, John. Yes, of course.
No, you have to disagree with it all.
Of course.
It's an all or nothing thing.
We have lots of problems with all the things you mentioned. Absolutely.
You would go up to some fat lady and say... are you an opera singer?
I am just rolling my eyes
David's
so hard
face
right
now.
So the...
I'm pretty sure that's a logical fallacy.
But we have, in the Christian church, we have made gay sex the one sin that we have permission to be disgusted by, that we have permission to condemn other people for. And in different times in church history, different sins have been the socially acceptable sin to publicly condemn and publicly shame people for, rather than...
But I don't think that even what's going on right now, Amanda, I think what's going on is fear. There's a fear culture that's saying if we don't stand up and say something or do something, we are going to lose our ability to speak freely on these issues and to exercise our faith freely.
That's a really good point. What do you think about that, David? That we live in a culture of fear? Because I feel like your point... originally was addressing that, like, it's really good for us to come out and say this because we're in the middle of a situation in our culture where it's a big issue. That just really resonated with me, John, because I think about all of the things that politically we do out of fear that, you know.
Well, I mean, we started talking about American happiness is the number one thing, but I think American security is the other huge thing. And we as Christians, we have no promises for security in the New Testament. We have promises for, following Jesus and not having a place to lay our heads. And I think that a lot of the – I read an article today as I was thinking about this from Wayne Grudem, who is one of the authors of this document. And he was one of the original supporters of Trump. And then once all the documents kind of came out, the big Fox News bus, whatever – episode, he kind of reneged on Trump and then kind of like gave him a backhanded like, but who else are you going to vote for? And
I hate that.
Why in his article he made these statements again and again about if we don't say something, we're going to have this agenda pushed on us and pushed on us and pushed on us. Yes, Wayne, we are. Deal with it.
I
disagree.
I
you can say
that...
I disagree.
I think that what you're saying about fear is probably pretty well founded. I think that the church probably does live in quite a bit of fear that
the American church.
The American church. And yeah. and it's a little silly when the church talks about, oh, we're being so
persecuted by our war on Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And of course it's a little bit silly.
I mean, like persecuted because we won't bake a cake.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously this person's,
persecuted because the government says I have to issue a wedding license. Like, I am not participating in the ceremony if I am a county clerk and I draw up papers. I'm not responsible before God for that action.
Or if you're convicted that you are, is your county clerk position worth it?
Right. Exactly. Well, you could go do something else. So,
well, clearly.
John, I want to go back just a little bit to
that's fair. I kind of went on a rant.
Your argument.
You never do that.
About that this is the same thing as telling a fat lady that she's fat.
Why do we make it a lady? Are you a feminist?
I was just going to say that.
Kaboom! Well, you
wouldn't
know.
Go up to a fat guy because he could punch you and it would hurt.
That's right. So, the Nashville statement, the thing that really struck me as I read through it is I kept seeing a lot of grace. It kept talking about this is the way that the scriptures show that we are supposed to live. This is what grace is. I like Article 12. We deny that the grace of God in Christ is insufficient to forgive all sexual sin and to give power for holiness to every believer who feels drawn into sexual sin. We affirm that the grace of God in Christ gives both merciful pardon and transforming power. It's not just a hammer saying, ooh, gay people, you're bad. It's showing the grace of God. It's showing the truth of Scripture, and it's showing the right way forward. And what I keep coming back to is truth is always worth saying, as long as it's said in love. And I really think that there's a lot of love in the Nashville statement. I see a lot of grace and lot of truth.
So going back to the analogy of the fat person of who knows what their self-conception of themselves is.
some generic gender.
Goodness. Serious things are a punchline.
The statement that you just made was things have to be said in love. And there are loving times that you can go up to a person who has a weight problem and say, you got a problem. We need to deal with it or you're not going to be around for your kids someday. But there's very few people who have the right to say those kinds of things.
Agreed.
And those kinds of things can only be said after years of relationship and listening and following along the life's pathways with those people. You two have the proximity in my life to come up to me and say, John, you're being an idiot. But not a lot of people have that proximity. And for us to have that kind of proximity to people who are struggling, genuinely struggling with the question of gender, it ain't going to happen over a statement. But faith does come by hearing, and hearing through the word of what? The Nashville statement? No, the word of God. And I don't think many people are going to come to a saving realization of their sinfulness based off of reading Sodom and Gomorrah any more than reading anything in the New Testament. It's far more likely that somebody's going to come to a saving understanding of grace by reading the Sermon on the Mount.
The Nashville
But God can work in weird ways. God can work with Sodom and Gomorrah, but I don't think he's going to work through the Nashville statement.
The Nashville statement is filled with the word of God, though.
No, it's not. It's extrapolations and interpretation. It's like a commentary.
And I'm just going to run right over that. the other problem with just connecting this to the argument about a fat person is that we're not just talking. The Nashville statement is not going and talking to the fat person and saying, hey, you're fat. We're saying, hey, as a society, we should not be saying that, yes, obesity is a great thing, because obesity is not a great thing. Mm-hmm. That's what this is saying.
Okay, so with the fat person analogy again, because this is apparently our thing, what is the rate of obesity in the United States?
High.
Very high. In the church, really, really high.
Is it higher in the church than in...
No, but it's really, really high, and the church is definitely no different.
Sure.
So is in, you know, a church council statement on the sin of gluttony a productive way to disciple people on the issue?
It's not a cultural issue.
Gluttony's not a cultural issue?
Oh, I'd say
gluttony's totally disagree.
Oh, man.
You went and said that and you didn't think about it, did you? No,
it's like when you're playing chess and you see the knight move and you're like, yes, I got him.
Oh, no. Man. There goes my queen.
There goes my queen. I mean, the king.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think... So there's a double issue here. One, I don't think a public statement of declaration on gluttony with quotations from Proverbs is the most productive way to deal with that issue. But also, isn't it telling that there we have a Nashville statement on the sexuality issues and not one on divorce and not one on pornography and not one on gluttony and not one on materialism?
But the issue is that... Everybody agrees that gluttony is not a good thing.
Except
and that obesity
we all do
is,
it.
Well, sure. But everybody agrees that obesity is not a good thing. But there is a serious disagreement about gender and about issues of gender and sexuality.
I think everybody agrees that we're way off track here, and I don't know if this is a productive line at all, but I think everybody agrees that being fat is not great.
Sure.
But I don't think that we agree culturally in the church or out of it that gluttony is a sin.
Sure. Sure. I could.
In which case, a declaration about the sinfulness of gluttony might be more apropos, because the world is not at all confused about what conservative Christians think about sexuality.
The world is not saying.
And here's the thing, is that folks within the big tent of the church aren't confused either. They aren't. We didn't need to have a better definition for what the Orthodox view of marriage was. The people who didn't have an Orthodox view of marriage, this doesn't help them.
But we do, I think why this resonates with you, David, is because we as the church do need to have clearer teaching on the Christian doctrines of marriage and sexuality. We do as a church need to have better discipleship. We do as a church need to know how we as individual Christians are going to deal with the people in our life that struggle with these issues. We do need to know how to talk about it in the public square and in private. And so feeling that need and seeing it and seeing how confused our culture is, I think the somebody saying something definitive resonates with you because you can see that need. And I think that where you and John and probably I really disagree is in thinking whether or not this is even addressing the issue that we all agree is there and we can all see. Because I don't think this is working for what they think it's working for. But I think we agree that things need to be said.
So absolutely. So if things need to be said, who's going to say them?
You.
Me. The pastor, the teacher,
me.
The people of
had this conversation
influence.
In my classroom today.
The whole conversation has to back up from the Nashville statement, and these conversations need to be had at a level where we aren't marrying people in our churches when we know that there is a really high probability that they're going to get divorced because they just want to do the right thing.
I think we need to back up further. And we need to be teaching our children, which presumably we are, but we as a church need to be talking to each other. Hey, parents, are you teaching your children what marriage is? Are you teaching them what it's meant to be? Are you teaching your teenagers in youth group
instead
to
of
how to play
based.
Chubby Bunny? Or are you teaching them that their awakening sexuality
is a
ordained,
bad thing,
yes,
and should
dirty,
be suppressed,
nasty, go
and
hide,
feared,
yes,
above all other things?
Like at every stage of development, in all aspects of our Christian walk, we need to be suffused with the beauty of the gospel image of marriage. Mm-hmm. And we need to be loving our spouses better because that's telling everyone around us something about what we believe about marriage. And we need to be counseling our friends and our children.
So going back to the Nashville statement one more time, Yes. There are several people who signed off on this that I have high respect for. Russell Moore is one of the signers.
I have a great deal of respect for him.
I have a great deal of respect for him. I have a great deal of respect for Francis Chan. I believe he was that. Is that right?
Yeah, he's
Albert
one of the
Mueller.
Signers.
There are a number of people. So I am not saying that these guys or girls. Are there any girls who signed on this?
And are you a feminist?
I don't see any.
And I think that just proved the point, right?
We might have it right here.
There. So there is some concern on my part that I don't see people on this list like who might be who still fall well within the context of the evangelical conservative camp, but we don't see is Tim Keller on this list?
I don't see Tim Keller on the list.
I'm blanking right now on names, but like. We should be seeing people run to the list. If it's just the Dr. Dobsons of the world who are on this list, that's not that we all we've done is built a beautiful wall.
Right. Best wall. It's huge.
It's huge.
You know, my hope is and maybe this
built
is
built on
the hope.
Nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Is that your hope?
Is that through the text here that this would serve as an inspiration for pastors, for teachers, for people in regular life to take this truth to the people they know.
So I think what it inspires me to do is to think about the better ways to engage in this conversation. And I wish I didn't have to argue against something that people I respect are signing off on or something that's attempting to address something that I agree is an issue. And I don't want to spend my Christian life, you know, nitpicking, well, we could have done that better. But I think there are issues with how this is going to affect people's lives. I mean, I know people who struggle with these issues and their faith, and this is not helpful.
Yeah. I don't think David's position is all that different though than a lot of Christians. So out of respect for David, and he and I are longtime friends, and so we aren't. My fear would be this, is that I can walk up to a person with an egalitarian point of view and say, you know, there's some points of view that I disagree with you on, but in general, I think you're part of the church.
Wait, you're Orthodox.
My concern would be, are the authors of the Nashville Statement going to say, you didn't sign my statement?
I don't think they're saying that.
And then how much more would people who struggle with same-sex attraction, who are trying to be Christians, who are Christians.
Right.
People who are struggling with same-sex attraction, who are Christians, and even are saying, look, I think an Orthodox view of marriage is what I see in the Bible. This document seems to be pushing that conversation, pushing that group of people further out the door.
So
I feel like I'm on the outside if I don't sign this document, how much more is a person who's actually struggling with these issues going to feel that?
Now the counter to that or the other thing to consider is a definitive statement of the truth can be a lifeline to someone who's struggling.
The preamble says, we are persuaded that faithfulness in our generation means declaring once again the true story of the world and our place in it, particularly as male and female.
We're not going to come to a comfortable conclusion, are we?
We are not.
That's okay.
But what a great argument.
I think we actually had a Donnybrook today.
That was a good one. Alrighty. Well, thanks everybody for being with us once again. We've had a lot of fun Donnybrooking here, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Please go to donnybrookpodcast.com and send in some feedback. We'd love to discuss your topic next time we're together. So until then, we'll be signing off. I'm David.
And I'm Amanda.
John.
We'll see you next time.